Welcome to Whiskey and IR Theory, the podcast where two middle-aged academics drink whiskey and talk about IR theory. It really is just what the title says. This is part the second of a two-part series of episodes on Yaching Chin's 2018 book, A Relational Theory of World Politics. If you've listened to prior episodes, you have a pretty good idea of what you're in for. If this is your first episode, on the other hand, then I urge you to hit stop or pause now and start with an earlier one. At least, listen to part one first, because otherwise this isn't going to make any sense to you. There's no other bookend in this episode, so now is the time for me to remind you that our music is performed by Lyra Gemmell-Nexon, that you can subscribe to the pod on Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, and that if you like the podcast, could you do us the favor of giving us a 5-star rating or a positive review or both at whatever service you stream the podcast from? Now, without further ado, we rejoin our conversation midstream. You've already kind of gotten to this, but he says that the problem with us and with Emmerbeer and with a lot of the other Western relational scholars, although interestingly enough, what he says here clearly doesn't apply to Bourdieu, but which is that we don't have humans as the Cree relators, right? And we don't, relational context where she, that is the human agent, is situated, which can be termed actor context imminency, right? Okay. Which is...
What page are you on?
Yeah, I'm on page 115. Okay. And that's where he says, you know, a key difference between my approach and Jackson and Nexon is that my relations have to be human, theirs don't. And he wants to talk very extensively about humans. And then he gets into this other line of argument about how, you know, we're just sort of interested in entity formation. And as you alluded to, part of that, this is a broader critique of Western relationalism, that it doesn't have human agents as centered as they ought to be, that it doesn't take their mutual constitution seriously enough. I would say that what he's pointing out is a tendency maybe towards structuralism introduced by network analytic concepts, even though I don't think that's how he describes it. And what he's missing here, it does not seem to occur to him that these might be analytical moves, right, rather than ontological moves. Right. So, for example, that when we talk about relations before states, this is an analytical... We're talking about the idea that everything is constituted by relations, and it's a pun, right? But more than that, we're making an analytical claim. If you want to explain entity formation, this is where you start.
Yep, exactly. This gets to probably the biggest concern that I have with the text all the way through, which is related to the point I was making earlier, much earlier, about the way that this isn't really an explanatory book, that there's no sense of any status that a theoretical concept could have except as an ontological claim. So there is no analytical, as you said, there's no way to think about this as a kind of analytical cut. There's no evaluation of what a particular cut gets you in a sort of instrumental sense. It's interesting, and we were talking about this before, sort of informally, before we started the podcast. There's a weird way that this argument feels, not in content, but in form, like the sort of arguments you find in a certain species of very thinly theorized IR realism. Like, this is how the world is, and because this is the way the world is, certain kinds of things follow from it. Which is not at all the way that certainly I've tried to make arguments about relational theory over the years, and certainly not the people that we draw on, who tend to be much more interested in saying, well, what does this assumption get you analytically? What does it get you explanatorily? That doesn't seem to be his point. And that's about the only way I can make sense out of this continued assertion that he has about the importance of grounding, you know, it's foregrounding or centering the human being. So on that page 115, the thing you were quoting, there's the line that he uses, and I think it's a very valid point of difference with us, or with me at least. I'm not sure if you still agree with us. Relation for them is a general and impersonal force whose presence brings about the configurations of processes as the creator of the individual entities. Well, yeah, I I would agree that that's kind of the baseline that, that if you're trying to talk about why we have entities, then you have to start there. That's, that was the claim that we made, and I still completely buy that claim. But it's not, that's not a claim that, like, historically that's how it happened. Whereas I get the feeling that for him, the critique is, well, but it couldn't have happened historically that way because there are people who are doing these things. And I'm not 100% sure what to do with that.
Yeah, we should be clear. This is not thinly theorized. I mean, we're a third of the way through. We've had a lot to talk about. It's very deeply theorized. So one interpretation is that humans are important because they're important. And he thinks they're important. So they're important. We should have them. And he talks about humans as emotional animals. You know, he talks about Khrushchev banging his shoe, how they can be rational, non-rational, irrational. It's very humanistic, right? I mean, this is really, we're using this Western philosophical category, but this is real humanism. But I think that the, if I were going, if you, we were in a seminar and you were a grad student making those arguments and I wanted, nobody was pushing back and I wanted to push back, I would say, but isn't that the point of his argument about cultural starting places? He doesn't have to defend it the way that we want him to, because he's saying this is the way the background knowledge is that I'm deriving this theory from, and you should let that be put in motion and be part of the conversation in order to enrich IR theory.
And if we were in that seminar, then I think what I would say back to Professor Nexon would be, okay, but even if we grant him that, isn't he now obligated to tell us what that assumption gets us, other than its congruence with his particular construal of the Confucian cultural heritage? I grant him that. I don't know enough about the debates in Confucian philosophy to know whether he's correct about this, so let's just grant him that. But even if we said that, okay, he's shown that this is rooted in a different tradition. Gotcha. So what? What should we then do with that? What does that tell me that I wouldn't know otherwise? So that would be the next question that I would want to kind of push for a little bit. And hopefully there'd be other people in the seminar than just you and me, and somebody else would come up with a response at that point. But
the bulk of this chapter, I mean, is, you know, a really interesting attempt to ground relational principles that we're very familiar with, having been immersed in that literature for a while, in Chinese authors, essentially Chinese philosophers. And I thought that was interesting. I mean, I sort of was like, you know, I was reading and I was making a note, okay, this is where he's making this argument, this is where he makes that argument. But I think it's worth just mentioning in passing his discussion of coexistence. So he wants to talk about relationality in terms of the idea of coexistence rather than interactions. You know, it's the kind of, it's very similar to the Dewey and Bentley distinction, essential opposites. So, and they're co in the sense that they're always commingled, co-produced. And he says, this is on 123, one is that self-existence has an ontological primacy over coexistence. This is the people are wrong. And the other, coexistence comes before self-existence. Rather, my coexistence assumption places emphasis on the simultaneity of self-existence and coexistency, meaning that the existence of the self is at the same time a coexistence of this self with others in a social setting. Self-existence cannot stand by itself and does not come before or after coexistence. But what's a little bit weird here, again, is this is where I think the analytical stuff matters. I just, I don't think that most relationalists would disagree with that.
Yeah, I don't either.
And the fact that, you know, so, okay, you can say it, you know, but the sort of most relationalists say, let's move on at this point to like what theories we're going to use, right? You know, maybe even more middle range theories, or at least frameworks, which he is, we're going to get to. He has a framework and a fairly interesting one. But so there's a lot of the kind of stuff that, you know, okay, well, you can say it's simultaneity. You can say that we should always be aware of it when we're doing theory. But I think that's not actually all that distinctive. I mean, maybe he doesn't even think it's distinctive from relationalism here because he's talking about these other approaches. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that all theories, when the rubber hits the road, are going to have consistency problems with this proposition. Does that make any sense?
No, I agree. And I think that the thing that we ought to be asking, and we've asked before, is, okay, let's not worry so much about the consistency issue. Let's worry about the payoff. What does it get us? I don't know what, if I apply the sort of pragmatist rule here, like what is the cash value of the distinction? I'm not quite sure with that paragraph on 122. I'm not quite sure what difference it makes, whether self-existence comes at the same time or after coexistence. And I'm not sure that the rest of the book gives me much information to use to answer that. I still don't know quite what difference it would make, particularly since most relational theorists that I'm familiar with would not disagree with that. But it's a very important distinction for him, and I'm just not quite sure what's at stake.
But it's important.
It's important. I agree. But what's interesting is the chapter goes on. I think I mentioned this before, but I'll say it again just to sort of wrap the chapter up. When you get to the end of the chapter where he starts talking about, you know, go through the thing about relational webs, he has this argument about agency and ambiguity, which is exactly the argument that we and other relationalists make all the time, right? Ambiguity implies uncertainty, which creates opportunity for creation. The future is uncertain. Human agency can play a significant role to create something new, etc., etc. So agency is creativity and contingency and is related to ambiguity and insufficiency of structural determinism. Sure, I think that's most of the people that I think would go in the relationalist camp would agree with that. So,
yeah, I guess I sort of feel like part of his sense might be is that our language is too cold and clinical about this.
Mm. Yeah.
But I don't think we should move on quite yet, because the world of relation stuff, the web is... So he has the coexistence argument, right, which is essentially, you know, sort of if you know you're Elias, it's very similar to Elias. So mm-hmm. pushes a little bit further, and again, grounds it in Chinese figures, authors, philosophers. He says that we should be thinking about co-interest, which... I don't know, what did you make of that discussion?
I don't think I understood that discussion until about three chapters further on.
Okay, so we'll talk about it then.
Yeah, because I think when he starts talking about cooperation, he does a better job of talking about what a co-interest might be.
Mm-hmm. So then we have some diagrams that look a lot like ego network diagrams, mm-hmm. with the social positionality of the self in the center. And he says there are three layered concentric circles in his example. The primary one includes kinship. This is a big thing, blood relations as sort of primary relationships. The secondary is friendship partnership, and the tertiary are strangers. And then he has this nicely done diagram, figure 5.2, mm-hmm. where he shows that these can be embedded with one another so that actors are occupying multiple different subject positionalities in relation to other subject positionalities at once. And then he has this village analogy, and I like the village analogy. Put aside, you know, the Chinese village stuff. I mean, there are times he's talking about Chinese villages, I'm like, this just, you know, I don't mean to be Western universalist, or I don't mean to be culturally insensitive, but this sounds like a lot of agrarian peasant villages kind of anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Where, for sort of the functional reasons he points out, that people hang out in the same place mm-hmm. for a really long time, mm-hmm. and you know, only interact with each other. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what I liked is the idea, and I don't know where it is now, that he says where he uses the village metaphor to talk about international politics. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. Page 145. International society is perhaps more like the traditional agricultural village in this respect than a modern Western city. No, I thought it was a really neat parallel. You know, it's a small group that hangs out with each other and they can't go anywhere. And
they can't really escape from one another. Mm-hmm. They become very familiar with one another. Mm-hmm. And they have to relate to one another kind of all the time. I thought that was neat. And I actually think that's better than the standard kind of state of nature metaphors mm-hmm. that are used in IR.
Mm-hmm. I agree. No, I think there's something also neat about it, because the particular thing that's neat about it is that it's a... it's a metaphor of ways in which people are going about their lives. And it calls attention, and he's explicit about this in later chapters, it calls attention to kind of the background practice level of international relations as being the sort of, you know, everyday life in the international village. That was one of those images that I'm kind of like, oh, that the next time I do an intro IR lecture, I might use that. That's a really neat way of encapsulating this. Now, using the network theoretical language that or network analytical language that I know we've played with a lot in the past. I mean, you could talk about this in terms of densities, right? You could talk about this in terms of boundedness. I want to go back to something you said before, though, about the cold and clinicalness of our language. I mean, I don't know. Is this really about tone? I mean, the substantive point doesn't seem all that different. Evocative about the metaphor that he uses to present this. You could present similar kinds of points by talking about interaction densities, right? I don't know. Is that really what we're talking about here? Just kind of the way in which this is presented, the emotional color of the theory?
Well, I'm just offering a possibility for why some of the things that where we are like, yeah, that's exactly what most relationalists say, which isn't a diminishment of what he's arguing, mm-hmm. but just some mm-hmm. of the contrast he's drawing, I don't really see. I think it's just that a lot of our work is not very interested in the emotions of human beings. I think the network stuff really contributes to that because terms like network density have this naturalist social science tinge. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's just the best I can come up with, right? Is that we just don't, that a lot of the people he's working with don't stake a claim on that. So they don't say, you know, we are putting human beings at the center. And if you think about, though, like in the first wave of my work was very Zimmelian, so I was interested in the formal properties of networks, not their content. Their content came in later. And while I think he does present formal ego networks with subject positionalities, I think he's ultimately really interested in content of relations. And I think that's also why the human element is so important for him, because in all the moves at the beginning about the interpretiveness of social science, he is interested in the meanings that actors are ascribing to one another through their relationships. And I think that he's right that in some of the IR work he's drawing on, that is not as centered. Now, if he went to some other sociologists working this idiom, he would find a different story, mm-hmm. for example. And if he also went to some of the sort of empirical work where there's, you know, kind of a lot about people doing stuff, right? And a lot more kind of constructivist-y content stuff. You know, think about Stacy's work, for example, or even, you know, my first book, or your book, right? I mean, which is, despite the dense philosophy, you know, is about actors making arguments and to affect their relations with one another. You know, that might be it. I'm speculating. I'm spitballing here because I don't really have a good explanation for why he thinks agents are as absent from the work as agency is so absent from the work, or human beings are so absent from the work. So I think it has something to do with the network language. That's the best I can come up with.
No, that's really interesting. I hadn't quite formulated it that way, but that's that feels right to me. That feels like mm-hmm. That feels like a useful way of characterizing what he's doing.
So then the next chapter is on meta relationships and the Zhang-Yong dialectics.
Mm-hmm.
This is Hegel and stuff, so I'm just going to let you say what you think of it.
Wait, since when did I become the Hegel guy? You're the Hegel guy.
Yeah. But I'm not. But my Hegel stuff is all the political theory. It's not the dialecticism.
Okay.
I mean, it's obviously dialectic, but I mean, like, you know, I don't spend a lot of time on this phenomenology. I spend time on the philosophy of right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, yeah. That's fair. I mean, okay. So basically, the distinction he wants to draw here in this sixth chapter is he wants to draw the difference between Hegelian dialectics on the one hand and these Zhang-Yong, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that terribly, dialectics on the other. So the Hegelian dialectics, the presentation that he gives is it's about the conflict between a thesis and an antithesis and the centrality of the irreconcilable opposites that collide with one another. That's sort of the motor of the dialectic for Hegel. He argues that the Zhang-Yong dialectics, which clicked for me on page 171 when he put in the yin-yang diagram. I was like, oh, is that what we're talking about here? Okay, cool. I suppose if I knew more about Chinese philosophy, I would have recognized that right away. But the Zhongyang dialectic notion is taking that yin-yang symbol seriously. And the main difference is that it's not just two irreconcilable opposites that are in conflict with each other, but there is this co-implication. So in order to have the yin-yang diagram within the white sort of fish part, there's a little black dot. Within the black fish part, there's a white dot. So the idea is that things that appear to be irreconcilable opposites actually aren't, because they actually are co-implicated. They actually have sort of traces of one another in them. And therefore, the dynamic of that dialectic, the way he sketches it, is not towards synthesis, which is what happens in the Hegelian system, where the conflict is sublimated or Aufhebung into a synthesis. Instead, what you have is harmony. You have a perpetual opposition that never quite settles down, and it's balanced tension is what the Zhongyang dialectic points to. So conflict from the Hegelian side, imminent inclusivity from the Zhongyang or yin yang side. The thing that I was mostly trying to figure out as I'm reading through this chapter was, okay, so why are we talking about this right now? Why at this point in the argument are we talking about these two different kinds of dialectics? And it occurred to me about halfway through the chapter that the reason I was having a hard time figuring it out is because I tend to think of dialectics as a way of understanding how knowledge is produced, as a methodology. It's a dialectical, historical materialist methodology. And he isn't using it that way. For him, these two modes of dialectic are essentially theoretical claims about the centrality of conflict on the one hand and harmony or balance on the other hand. And so the point that he wants to make is that these two different kinds of traditions have thought about tension in different ways. The Hegelian version would say conflict, which has to lead to some kind of resolution, which then either becomes some sort of authority pattern, or in later chapters he'll develop this in terms of formal rules. Or the Zhongyang version, which is dynamic tension, inclusive immanence, balance, and harmony, which leads to these sets of informal social relational maintenance strategies that he's going to talk about for the rest of the book. So once it occurred to me that this was really a chapter about theory rather than a chapter about methodology, it kind of clicked for me, and I was like, oh, is that what he's doing? I don't know, is that what you thought he was doing in the chapter?
Yeah, I mean, I think I can say yes, because you've just done such a good job and you can let me off the hook. The thing that struck me most about this chapter is the sections where he cites various kinds of studies anecdotally to drive home the argument that this is a cultural difference, mm-hmm. right? That Hegelian dialectics are kind of essential to Western ways of engaging with the world, as opposed to Zhongyang dialectics, which are the ways in which people of Chinese ethnicity relate to the world. And so I think it's doing more of the work in trying to say that there is something distinctive about the cultural context of his theory. And I think it's also doing this sort of meta story throughout the book, which is that China is going to have different kinds of foreign policy practices than the West is. And this goes back to this thing I said at the outset about the role of the concept of civilizational diversity in Chinese foreign policy, mm-hmm. and polycentrism in Chinese foreign policy, which is a little bit in tension, actually. So you've got this sort of line about in that we should have civilizational diversity, which means functionally respect for sovereignty in those states that are homologous with civilizations. It's a very interesting discussion somewhere. I think we already passed it about India, because India is named for civilization. It's a nation state. We sometimes confuse civilizational cultures with national cultures. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of interesting. I didn't really quite know what to make of it. Thought that you might go off on this because you're the civilizations guy.
But I could. I could.
I'm not sure. I don't know. Do we want to open that can of worms?
I don't know.
Look, fundamentally, like, so there's the sense in which you have civilizational diversity and polycentrism and balance and equilibrium as principles that have been elevated as blueprints for the democratization of international affairs. And there's this element running through the book, mm-hmm. where you've got a kind of fractal where international relations as it is practiced is being reflected fractally, and IR is a discipline, which I don't think is wrong, but I think it's this thing you have about kind of, it's, you know, it's turtles all the way down. In the sense, it's the same things all the way down. And that's both a virtue of the argument, but it's also, I think, significant. So on the one hand, you have this idea that you have this idea about civilizational diversity, about polycentric equilibriums, about not necessarily having to resolve things by a fixed final rule, which are all kinds of things that make a lot of sense if you're a rising power in an international system with a global hegemon who is making claims about the proper things to do in domestic politics that are threatening to your regime's survival. And it also makes sense in a kind of broader cultural context of a post-Western imperial, you know, mm-hmm. system. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit oddly in tension with the stuff about natural hierarchy in East Asia.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff about that was sort of, I think, is kind of there in the managerial relation stuff, and I think is what got exploded at this workshop where we were just kind of like, what the hell is going on here? We don't understand any of this. Mm-hmm. But that being said, so I do think that to me is kind of, that's just an interesting kind of leitmotif. That's what I kind of got out of here, is this sort of, again, this is a cultural difference,
right,
which leads to some degree of civilizational value and commensurability, although it's heavily qualified and doesn't preclude dialogue and mutual respect.
Right. But then is also, as he'll develop a little bit in later chapters, harmony doesn't come with any postulate of equality. So harmony can come very much with these five Confucian central relations, which are, four of them are hierarchical. So it's a different shuffling of some of the same concepts that definitely doesn't look like the sort of default ordering that we might expect if we operated with these kinds of Western, vaguely individualist, liberal understandings of how political and social order is supposed to work.
So the next chapter is the logic of relationality, and I thought this was really interesting, and I also thought this is where the argument just becomes decisionist, and I don't really understand entirely what's going on here in terms of the meta theory before then.
Yeah. This was the point at which this chapter 7, where he sort of goes into these different logics of, it has these three logics: logic of rationality, logic of practicality. He says those two are characteristic of Western IR. And then there's this logic of relationality, which is the thing that he's been developing throughout the rest of the book. And he kind of wants to make them speak to each other. But this is where the kinds of tensions and ambiguities that we've been talking about so far, about the cultural particularity versus universality or broader reach of the argument, where they kind of come to a head for me. Because on the one hand, he says there are relational logics, which are characteristic of relational cultures. And then he says the logic of relationality is more fundamental than the logic of rationality, to the point where rationality is only ever a relational rationality. And he sort of has both of those claims going on at the same time, and I'm not quite sure what to do with that, particularly because his logic of relationality, the way he cashes it out, seems often to be an argument that the rational actor takes account of their social relations and the social capital that they have and patterns of reciprocity, which he then names in Chinese rather than naming in English, but it seems very much like our basic reciprocity argument. So it was oddly confusing to me in a number of ways, because I wasn't quite sure that the chapter effectively demonstrated a real difference that a logic of relationality would make. It seemed like more of a modification than a fundamental incommensurable difference.
But there's a sort of intellectual path dependency here, right? So he has the logic rationality, which harkens back to the earlier chapters we already talked about, where he, I think, correctly notes that there's some fundamental similarities between the idea that actors are weighing consequences and then choosing the best outcome from them based on their preference structure versus weighing what the right, what their role is in the situation and what the right norm is to follow, and, you know, with the logic of appropriateness. Mm-hmm. And then the logic of argument, which isn't really a parallel logic anyway, but is often in there, you know, which is the, you know, communicative rationality, the idea that there are conditions in which rational persuasion is the logic by which we do things. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then you have the logic of practicality, which is Pouliot's sort of way of, again, trying to make his importation of Bourdieusian theory symmetrical with these other ways that we're talking about things in the field. And the logic of practicality focuses on background knowledge, the idea that, you know, you're doing things through kind of tacit knowledge, not quite habit, but not what he would say call representational approaches. So you're not consciously thinking, I am doing this because of X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. You're doing it because you have sort of basic competency. It's kind of rote.
Mm-hmm. It's what Giddens would call practical consciousness.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then he has this interesting argument, I think, where he says that he doesn't agree with this distinction between practical knowledge and representational versions. So representational versions where it's in our mind. So the logic of, just to make sure we're clear about this, the idea is that the logic of appropriateness, which says, I do this because it is the normatively correct thing to do. Mm-hmm. Elster has this example where he says, you know, triage is a good example of a norm. It's a logic by which, you know, because in triage roles, you go to the person who's closest to death first and you work your way backward. And that he says, we know that's a norm because from a kind of consequentialist perspective, it's not necessarily rational. You know, if you really wanted to maximize the number of lives saved, you would go for the middle, the people who, if you left alone, would deteriorate and might get really bad. You'd let the people really bad die and, you know, whatever. I mean, so he then says, you know, this is a norm. It's a rule of appropriate behavior that doctors have about how they orient, or in fact, usually nurse practitioners are going to orient, are going to sort patients. Mm-hmm. You might have norms like, you know, it might be rationally efficacious for me to steal that $10 I see sitting on a table. Nobody's ever going to figure out that I did it. Nobody is around. But normatively, I know that's not the right thing to do. And the idea is that these are representational because I'm actually thinking like, oh, that's unethical. I'm not going to do that. So he says that background knowledge is not an alternative representation knowledge, but provides the foundation or the background for it. Because knowledge production itself is practice and therefore rests on the background of a community of practice, which a cultural community is most representative, which is not a critique of Pouliot.
Right.
As best I can tell.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. That. Yeah. Vincent basically says that, so.
You know, but okay, fine, whatever. Then he has this other interesting argument that I think is worth noting. I think it's here. If it's not, I'm going to talk about it anyway. Which is, he draws a distinction between the kinds of communities of practice that people like Emmanuel invoke often, that Vincent and Rebecca study, mm-hmm. or that a whole host of people in practice turn theory study. Things like communities of diplomatic practice, right. Or communities, things that are what Emmanuel would have called epistemic communities back in the late 80s, early 90s. And he says that this is not really like communities of practice of the type that he says generate incommensurabilities. And one reason, of course, is that we know they're not, because, you know, people who are in physics get together and share practices across a wide variety of civilizations and cultures. And because there are kind of diplomatic norms and practices that everybody learns, you know, when they hang out at the UN for long enough or what have you, or that you're socialized into. But he doesn't think these are like... These cannot be like the kinds of communities of practice that produces social theories. So then he has this kind of interesting discussion about academics as a community of practice. I don't know. What did you think was going on here? Or did this even register for you?
It did. Give me a second. I need to remember which page that particular discussion is on.
So the thing I just read on 202, he says, think of an academic community.
Right.
It resembles a diplomatic community in most respects. Its members come together, discuss and deliberate, form rules and norms, and do as practitioners in knowledge production and reproduction. If we say that a community of diplomats or a community of Red Cross workers is a community of practice, there is no reason to say that a community of academicians is not a community of practice. Representation is practice. If this view stands, representational knowledge is closely related to background knowledge. On the one hand, background knowledge lays the foundation on which representational knowledge grows. On the other hand, representational knowledge actualizes and manifests the background knowledge. The key is still the producer of knowledge, who is at the same time immersed in the background knowledge of a cultural community, and the representational knowledge she produces rests at the deeper level on the background knowledge of the community. It is hard to imagine that a social scholar immersed in a certain community practice and shaped for the background knowledge thereof may produce some representational knowledge absolutely alien to such background knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the background knowledge is a wider community for him than just the academic community.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a, this is a sort of, it's a repetition with variation of the cultural diversity argument from the earlier part of the book. So here is a group of American academics, and of course they're going to produce an American style theory because of this background knowledge that they are embedded in. The location of background knowledge is a lot more ambiguous in this account than the location of these other kinds of knowledges. Because if we really take the community practice notion seriously, then the community carries the background knowledge, and there's no necessary reason why the background knowledge of a group of scholars would necessarily have to also participate in the background knowledge of some broader cultural context that it was embedded in. It could actually be a subset of it. I think about, we've talked about this in previous episodes of this podcast, there are times in the history of American IR that Marxism has been a huge deal. And the fortunes of Marxist analysis has gone sort of up and down. But I think it's fair to say that whatever that is, that's not drawing on background knowledge that's deeply embedded in something called an American cultural community. Because there isn't an American cultural community background knowledge that's especially Marxist. So there's some kind of conditional autonomy of the academic community from the cultural background. But in this account, he wants to kind of smush them together. And I think it has more to do with him continuing to need to establish or want to establish, no, there are different ways that different academic communities could construct these things. There are different cultural assumptions that have been introduced here.
And then he accuses this line of argument as being dualistic, which is fine, mm-hmm. right? I mean, mm-hmm. this, you know, it's the analytical versus ontological question. And this is sort of the kind of question that launches a thousand internecine arguments. Right. I mean, because it's the, you know, you make a strong ontological claim, then you have to go out and do theory, and you then do stuff analytically, which is kind of inconsistent with what you just said ontologically. And then somebody reads you and says, aha, but this is inconsistent and we need to be consistent. And then they wind up going out doing stuff and producing analytics that are also somewhat inconsistent.
Yep.
I've become really jaded, haven't I? So let's get to the logic of relationality. As I read it, the logic of relationality puts the logic of the relationship as an interest of actors. I'm always considering my relationships and both the kind of obligations and implications of those relationships in my decisions and in my actions. I'm considering them both at the level of things like filial obligation, right, or obligation to a spouse. And I'm considering and how those obligations might balance against each other in conditions under which I have cross pressures. And I'm also considering my overall network of relations, or my larger network of relations, or at least the ones that are kind of phenomenologically relevant at the point, in my mind at the point, in terms of thinking how what I will do will affect those, with, I think, an eye towards conserving them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think that's, mm-hmm. you know, the sort of, I think there's a kind of assumption here that fundamentally what we're doing is trying to conserve them. And he uses this example of ASEAN. Well, no, this is, I'm thinking of a different discussion. He has this discussion of ASEAN where he says, which is much earlier, where he says the point of ASEAN is kind of, it's the logic is in the relationship itself. Just being in the relationship is the point, having that relationship, being there and interacting with one another. Because, you know, and then here he This is in fact an empirical description. There's like the core circle for ASEAN. You know, you're first in the ASEAN member states. Who's the example? Is it Singapore? Or is it just, what's the self here? No, ASEAN is the center. So ASEAN, okay. They have their dialogue partners. So you have these sort of concentric circles of social distance.
Right.
And social distance isn't necessarily understood in terms of physical distance. It's this primary, secondary, tertiary relationships, right? So they have to do with social distance, not in, again, the sense that we are social distancing, but in the sense of kind of who we think is closer or further away from the self.
Which is also the kind of thing that he talks about in terms of intimacy and importance on the, there's that little 2x2 on page 216, where he sort of does that, the cutting up into four quadrants and, you know, it's the intimacy and importance of relations. And no, I would broadly agree with you. I think the argument here seems to be, you know, this relational actor, or the relator, as he calls them, the relator is making decisions based on the quality of relations and the effects that their decisions will have on the maintenance of those relations over the longer term. The problem is, for me, that didn't sound at all different than most other kinds of decisionist logics, which would say that it's useful sometimes to do things not for immediate gain, but for long-term gain, or you do things based on diffuse reciprocity rather than specific reciprocity, or you invest in a connection with someone because it may pay off further down the road, or you value a relationship more highly because you think it's more important.
Where you develop trust and effective relations, and those then guide your behavior and your expectations about their behavior, make you, as you say, invest in the relationship so that maintaining it becomes an end of itself. Some of his arguments are, as you pointed out earlier, very similar to social capital arguments, arguments about information asymmetries, information symmetries when it gets into power that you gain from relationships, the ability to draw on certain kinds of resources through your relationships. So yeah, I mean, it was a little bit like, I mean, it's really interesting because it's sort of a different building block, but I didn't understand how this wasn't a decisionist argument.
Yeah, it didn't strike me as all that different from a decisionist argument. It's just a decisionist argument that uses social relational inputs, but we have those. So I'm not sure if this is supposed to be the payoff of the different cultural heritage of the Confucian relationalism. It didn't feel all that different to me.
Yeah, the example I got is, you know, balance theory, not balance of power theory, but balance theory and social network analysis, right? So that's a kind of approach that makes an assumption that people prefer balanced social relations. So I like it when my friends are friends, and it is unpleasant when my friends are enemies. And over time, actors will seek balance in their social relations. So if you have that kind of relationship where you are, your two friends are enemies, either they will become friends, or you will break off one of those relationships in order to ensure balance in your social relations. And you know, a balanced triad is like the self-sustaining equilibrium, right, in this approach. I've gotten it right, I'm remembering stuff from over 20 years ago, but I mean, this is very similar, right? It's essentially where the relationship, it's the mechanism of agent behavior is rooted in a feature of the relationships that they're in. And it's not one that has a kind of a mechanism which is, you know, consequentialist self-interest or normative, right? There's actually not a lot of, you know, you can build different assumptions about why you prefer balance, right? It's just that you prefer balance, much like his example of Romeo and Juliet, where Romeo has to choose between, you know, his romantic, intimate relationship with Juliet and his kinship ties with his close kinship ties with his parents, and has to balance that and fails, right? I mean, essentially, you know, winds up, you know, killing himself.
Right.
Because he's an idiot and can't wait a few minutes. but anyway, I mean, so... I'm just channeling Lyra here. Lyra just is like that. That whole play depends on people being stupid.
Welcome to Shakespearean tragedy.
So I mean, I think it's cool. I think it's neat. I mean, I think it's fine. I just don't. It doesn't strike me as ontologically distinctive. And then I wonder, is it because, you know, I'm on the outside looking in, and I just don't get it? I mean, it's a distinctive logic of action. It's just not distinctive on. at this very fundamental level.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me in some ways of discussions about the ASEAN way, which of course become important later in the book as well, or discussions about alternate pathways to modernization or development or something. And many of those pathways, when you examine them, turn out to be similar. They just have different kinds of cultural coloring, if you will. And so I wonder sort of what's really different about those sets of values, and the whole Asian values in manufacturing or something. Okay, well, but what are those values? And are those values actually incommensurate with other ways of thinking about production and manufacture? Not really. It's just some slight nuances. So again, this back to the question I had before with some of the earlier chapters, sometimes I don't quite understand what's at stake in making the distinction, except to say, as you formulated it earlier, and I tend to agree with this formulation, I think this is a good way of phrasing it, except to say that when we catch ourselves assimilating, we should stop and say, wait a minute, maybe we should allow this other thing to be part of the dialogue, because maybe we are missing something. Maybe there's something here that we're moving too quickly to bring it on board with stuff that we already know. But I had the same reaction. I was searching for the point of difference, and I wasn't really finding it.
Now, that being said, the fact that it may have fundamental similarities with things he's critiqued does not mean that it isn't interesting or opens up theoretical possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Does not mean that it is unimportant, and does not mean that it is an interesting way of thinking about social action. Although it has clear counterparts in Western sociology.
Right. Which actually, hold on, just as I'm thinking about this, I mean, if we take his own Zhongyang dialectics argument seriously, then there would have to be a little, dot of black in the white and a little bit of dot of white in the black. So we would see these kinds of similarities. So maybe that's actually not a problem. Maybe the problem would be simply if we were to take this and say, but there's really nothing different here.
Yeah. So, and I also think, again, I'm obsessed with this sort of stuff. I mean, he invokes, of course, the fact that China is, a lot of what is happening in Chinese foreign policy now is the construction of all these multilateral fora. There are a ton of them. I mean, I think I've probably said this before, but in the book, we have this diagram of increasing network ties between China and the rest of the world since 2010 via multilateral forum. And it's like a blob of stuff. I mean, I think Alex Montgomery, who did it for us, we spent some time trying to figure out how the heck we were going to make it even legible, because they formed all these new ties through all these different X plus one agreements and things like that. And we view it as building an alternative order, one in which China doesn't have to be subject to institutionalized rules of decision-making that have been set up by powers that are not China primarily, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
ones where it can bypass certain kinds of institutional arrangements. A lot of these are connected to the Belt and Road Initiative. So, I mean, there's a lot of that relationship building going on. And so there's also this interesting thing to sort of understand what would be a attempt to make theoretical sense of practice, the dialectic, if you will, between practice and knowledge, the same way that, we follow fads of what's interesting, in the same way that our theories tend to kind of mimic things that are relevant and important to us about what the United States is doing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. It's no accident, I think, that Karl Deutsch is writing about political community in the North Atlantic area in the late 40s, early 50s, because the strategies that the United States is pursuing, if you wanted to read them through this language, are really strategies about relationship cultivation, all these informal kinds of connections. I mean, what's the Fulbright program, right? This is about creating these kinds of ties and investing in these sorts of relations over the course of the long term. All the America houses and the tours of various jazz bands and so on, that the U.S. is trying to build up these sets of connections and tend these relations. And it's very different language, but I think what would be really interesting would be to read Deutsch against or in tension with this account. And I think that would be interesting, just sort of personally for me, it would be very interesting, because I tend to be much more immediately sympathetic to Deutsch's network language than I am to this language. Do you think we can do the last three chapters together?
Yeah, I think we're almost done.
Yeah, I think so.
Don't you?
We're getting to the
I think we've
here.
Actually covered the stuff that really interests us.
Mm-hmm.
Did
that make sense, though, the point about Deutsch?
Oh, yeah, it's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. Okay. To circle back to what I was saying earlier, circle back is one of those things that's entered my vocabulary and I can't banish it. And I think it might be kind of like DC speak in kind of policy circles.
Right. Mm-hmm. You've been infected.
I've been infected. I need to get treatment. But I actually think that what's interesting to me here is that, of course, this is very similar to a lot of the things that the United States was doing when it was establishing an order.
Mm-hmm.
And it's things that I think it's not so much that they are alien to the United States way of doing things or culturally distinctive in that sense. It's that we've effaced all of them, right? We take them for granted. They've been highly naturalized. So if somebody like Trump or Tillerson comes in and they're like, why the heck are we doing this? Why do we need this infrastructure? Why do we need this stuff? Isn't it just a waste of money? Not really realizing that this is, in fact, the sinews of American hegemony or American ordering. And so here I think you've got, you know, it would be interesting to see if, you know, if China were in a different place foreign policy-wise, right, or engaged in a different set of practices, what kinds of theory would be produced out of the same infrastructure?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it would look very similar. Maybe it wouldn't. I think that's the kind of question that's worth asking.
Mm-hmm. No, I think so. I think so.
Now, it is true that there are certain stereotypes about the way that Americans built these relationships. For example, that a lot of it involved teaching people to talk to Americans. Or that when the United States goes out and does, say, defense institutional reform, it wants to mimic, to some degree, American structures. So, you know, the joke was essentially that you know who to call, who the equivalent level to you is, rather than having to tease it out through a flowchart because you're looking at a completely different military organizational system or whatever. And this is then gets us into the next argument where he talks about management of relations and he talks about these two different philosophies, one of which is to homogenize and the other one is to maintain diversity. And he associates homogenization with the West,
mm-hmm.
right? Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not inconsistent with what I just talked about.
No, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, there's a weird moment at the end of near the end of the chapter where he's talking about the agential effect. So it's on page 222. So the meaning agential effect, meaning that a relator tends to make use of the relational context for some purposes of her own. It is the bottom up approach and shows the more instrumental and more agential dimension of relationality. And then, I mean, I had a weird double take moment because then he starts citing Lucian Pai to talk about like fundamental Chinese relations. And I'm like, wait a minute. Wow, that's very strange. You know, holy cultural essentialism, Batman. But what struck me about that, the phrasing of this, though, is this idea that like in order to have an agential effect, then there would have to be a way of isolating the purposes of the agent on her own. Whereas the directionality of a relational argument, I would think, would be to immerse the on her own in the relational context. But back again to this sort of humanism that we were talking about previously, it's, no, we know there's an agential effect when we can identify what the agent's own goals and purposes are and then talk about how those get implemented. So there that kind of doubleness of the agent and their environment comes back at the level of concrete application, even if it's been kind of dissolved in the relational ontology earlier on.
Okay, so I do want to double down on this. The logic of homogenization, because I was just rereading it as you were talking. I was rereading something. I'm sorry, we do that, right? The logic of homogenization, he explicitly talks about, he basically invokes, he talks about Marxist-Leninism and theories of homogeneity through Marxist-Leninist revolution, etc., right? And then he, of course, in passing, and then later we'll come back to the idea that what Thomas Wright calls the convergence wager underlies American and Western IR, Right? And this is the idea that the United States had in the 1990s, that if it could kind of extend economic interdependence or get some of liberal order into states, that they would all kind of converge on the same values and interests. So this is the whole rational justification for opening up trade relations with China to the extent that they did, permanent MFN status, entering the WTO, was that if you could just get economic liberalization rolling, you would wind up with a liberal democratic China, or at least a China that wasn't liberal democratic, wouldn't upset the apple cart in any way, because it would, of course, benefit in the same way from the system, see the same thing. We would have like nice management. We had convergence of states. And this is a logic that is very much in play in the United States in the 1990s, in which the United States is trying to do to China. However, it's not the only logic of international relations that occurs in the West, right? And I don't think he says it is, but you can certainly imagine all the ways in which, say, imperialism was not based on homogenization wagers, even though some homogenization came into the back door through civilizing missions, or that notions of cultural difference and essentialism crop up all the time in intra-European relations, or in the treatment of Asian polities. And he mentions that, right? He talks about that. So he clearly doesn't think that's embedded in the West. I just think it's the fact that he's talking about that, I think, is to some degree a, you know, kind of a very much, again, a reaction to, it feels of the moment. Mm-hmm. Although he does a good job of saying it's not by pointing to earlier instantiations of this. And this then this contrasts with the management of relations based on diversity, and here the argument starts to become normative.
Yes.
Right? This is how you should manage relations among diversity, and that is to accept diversity.
And not only is it a normative argument, but it's a normative argument that I think is in almost entirely separable from the relational ontology that he's been developing up until that point. So he suggests on page 228, the relational theory stresses more respect. It means one should not only tolerate diversity and difference, but also respect diversity and difference. Be that as it may, I'm not sure that that point logically follows from the relational ontology that he's been developing up until this point. It's not clear to me that a relational ontology insists on respect rather than mere tolerance, and it's also not clear to me that insisting on respect rather than mere tolerance requires relationalism. You could do that on an individualist basis as well, based on some notion of universal human dignity or something along those lines. So it seemed a very strange interpolation to suddenly drop that in, because it doesn't actually seem to follow from the logic of what he said before. I agree with you, it follows very much from the broader political and particularly international political context that is at least one of the threads that's informing the argument of this book.
And I think that's fine. As I said at the outset, this is no different than any American IR theory. It's just that sometimes we pretend that that isn't there in American IR theory. And we only notice it after the fact. Mm-hmm. But it is the case that American IR theory and propositions are driven by the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
And there's no way around it. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to sound condescending by saying, look, there are these things going on here. Well, A, because he's an important player in policy formulae, as I understand it. But B, because that's just the way things are, and it's actually consistent with his argument. And it is true that we tend to universalize things that are really driven by very particular concerns. And he has a nice discussion of hegemonic stability theory along those lines. This theory developed to make sense of United States preponderance and the U.S. role after 1945. And then it is elevated to a transhistorical theory because, oh, look, Thucydides said something that sounds like power transition theory in history of the Peloponnesian War.
Precisely.
So, aha, it's universal.
No, I think you're absolutely right. There is a way that we have to be careful because we're operating from the position of this dominant Anglophone theory where we were blind to the fact that we do that all the time in our theories anyway. We notice it very much in other people's theories. And we have to make sure that that's not turned into a way of dismissing other people's theories. So, yeah, I just wanted that. I think that's a good point to remind everybody of, that these are not dismissive criticisms. These are things we're noticing. But certainly, there are ample versions of that in our own accounts. I mean, what is the argument of Bob Cohan's After Hegemony, except the Western liberal order will persist, because it should. Like, you know, we're not immune from this.
Yeah, not at all. So, I think we need to move into the final third of the book, which is not quite as awful as it sounds, given how long this has elapsed, because the last third of the book, I think we have less to say about.
I think a lot of the things that I would say about the last third of the book, we've sort of already seeded. We've sort of talked about them already. They get, there are ways that, at least for me, I don't know what your experience of reading this book was, but I didn't really quite understand what was going on in this book until about midway through chapter 8. And then I got it. And then I went back and sort of noticed these other things. Like, oh, is that what's going on here?
So what is it?
So the thing that occurred to me in the middle of chapter 8, on page 273, in fact, is exactly...
This is in the Power and Relations chapter, yes. Which is the first chapter of the third section.
So this is... at the end of a section where he's talking about structural power, and he makes a comment about Foucault, concept of power, and he says, well, there's no specific owner of Foucault's notions of power, but it does imply a subject, the overt structure of the dominant ideology and the covert structure of background knowledge. And when I read that sentence, that was where it sort of clicked into place for me, that Chin doesn't operate with the notion that these theoretical concepts are analytical tools, that there is no analyticist moment or analytical moment in here. So Foucault talking about power as a kind of distributed, unowned structure isn't an ontological claim. Chin makes it into an ontological claim, and therefore it has to have a subject. Things that are arranged have to have an arranger. So the conductorless orchestra, to use not Foucault's metaphor, but Bourdieu's metaphor, actually has to have a conductor someplace. And logically that follows if you are operating with the idea that ontological propositions are just ontological, that they're not analytical. And once that occurred to me, then it sort of made the rest of the book make sense. It's like, oh, okay, so this is really a book that is operating with the idea that the point of theory is to flesh out ontology.
And that makes sense of the fact that he repeatedly insists that one of the failures of Western relational theory is the lack of a relator, right? Yes. And that's also a flaw, he says, happens and went. I actually do really like these sections. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there, particularly if you know some of the literature that he's playing in. Mm-hmm. A lot of smart stuff. But his primary argument, I think, as I read it, is that... So he says that there are these three different kinds of power. There's agentic power. Power is resources. It's not agentic power. It's agential power is resources, right? So sort of how big is your market?
Right,
the standard kind of stuff we're used to. Then there's structural power, and this gets a little bit odd because I'm not sure exactly what he's arguing here. I don't feel comfortable summarizing it.
Well, he seems to suggest that he wants to make a parallel between this agentic power that is owned by agents, that's a property that agents have, and then structural power. But structural power as being
owned by everyone.
Owned by everyone and no one, or owned by the network, right? Owned by the overall structure of things. Because it argues just above that thing I read about Foucault on 272. The ownership is always exclusive. This way of conceptualizing power goes with the ontology of self-existence, which stresses the individual being the starting point of almost everything under the sun. So, if structures are real entities, the same way agents are real entities, and if agents have properties which give them power, then it would follow that the structure, also being an entity, has properties that would give it power. And agents, by virtue of being in the structure, would be able to use that power in different ways. So again, it's a notion that only follows from the ontological reality of structure.
It's actually also, the more I think about it, it's kind of an interesting argument. It's not the way I articulate how structural power works in argument typically, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure it's so much wrong as just a little bit different than the way we would articulate it. You're looking at me in a very perplexed way.
I'm that's my go on face.
Well, so if I say, like, if I talk about something like an opportunity structure in social movement theory, I would say that there are aspects of the structure that facilitate mobilization if actors are able to trigger them or take advantage of them. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like the idea that there's like this power hanging out in the structure that somebody can kind of take along and grab that's sort of open to anybody.
Except the formulation that you gave, which I would be a little more comfortable with, wouldn't call structural dispositions power. We'd call them power resources or something, that they could be utilized, they could be acted on. His formulation...
Well, the structure creates opportunities and constraints, mm-hmm. and you know that's that is the action of power, is the creation of opportunities and constraints. But, you know, yeah, in most of these theories, the structure is relative stabilities and patterns of interaction, so, you know, it's co-constitution, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. et cetera. Go on.
Whereas for him, structure seems to be more autonomous, seems to be more of an entity, because the key thing for him is that both agentic power and structural power are exclusive, that they're owned by some entity. So agential power is owned by agents, and structural power is owned by the structure, which is the difference with relational power, because the big thing for him is relational power is shared. So you can borrow assets from each other and things like this.
So you're saying what he's saying, you are saying what he is saying, is in essence that this is essentially just downward causation from structure interpreted as power?
That's what I think he's saying.
Okay. I mean, causal power is a thing, right? I mean, you can discuss that as a kind of power. It's certainly not. I was sort of trying to, when I was going through this, I was thinking, you know, is Susan Strange going to make an appearance? Is this going to be sort of something like her concept of structural power? You know, is it kind of a little bit like weaponized interdependence and other arguments about network analysis? But you're right that it's not going to be, because those are going to go all into the relational powers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. section, right?
Which is that,
but he's not saying that structural power is a thing. He's saying we should be doing relational power, right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, it's not like he's saying it. I mean, we have to be clear. He's not saying ontologically this is what structure is. This is the kind of power it generates. And so when we do structural analysis, that's what we do. He's saying that relational accounts of power endogenize these other accounts. And so they are better, which is a very standard move. It's not a move that's unfamiliar to us.
Mm-hmm. I can see how he could read that.
So relational power is resources. This is an interesting discussion. It does sound a lot like kind of basic network and exchange theory, which he does name check. Mm-hmm. I think there's something beyond that going on there. I mean, this idea that you can borrow power, that you get power from your relationships, you can activate them, that... He, you know, alliances, what we might talk about as pooling power in traditional alliance theory, he calls as being sharing power.
Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he talks about wrenching, that sounds like diffuse reciprocity. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what's completely different about that. Maybe I shouldn't phrase it that way. The point that he's making with wrenching is the point that other people have made with notions of diffuse reciprocity and, you know, investments that don't have any time horizon attached to them. And the idea that, he says in 281, right, nobody can correctly evaluate the right price of wrenching. Okay. That sounds an awful lot like gift economies and those kind of analysis that other people have done by talking about gifts and exchanges and such. So I don't know that it's so much that there's anything different here as he's developing a similar kind of point from a very different
soil. But it is interesting. Like, so 264, he's talking about this idea of borrowing power, right? And this is what relationality mm-hmm. lets you do. The United States is able to use the institutional power of the IMF because it made a special arrangement with the institution when its own power played the most important role to establish the IMF. It is through this special relationship that the United States is able to borrow power resources from the international institution more than other members. What do you make of that?
I'm not sure what it means to locate a power resource in the IMF that the U.S. is then able to borrow. I'm not sure that I get the location of these things.
But is it that, the language is a little bit possessive in a way that it has a little bit of this kind of power is property feel that I think we're a little uncomfortable with. But it isn't all that different from saying the United States utilizes the institutional infrastructural resources of the IMF when it is able to make the IMF, say, give a loan to a client state on favorable terms. Or is it different from that?
I think I would prefer to say the IMF is part of the infrastructure of the dominance of the United States.
Right.
And so the U.S. doesn't have to borrow from it. It's not a separate thing. It's one of the tools. And it's been locked in as one of the tools, right? So there's sort of structural bias of the way the IMF is set up in terms of who gets privileged and so
on. There is some relative autonomy. I mean, the European Union, the Europeans have a vote. I mean, the Europeans get to choose the head of the IMF, right? We get to choose the World Bank. They get to choose the IMF. And So it is a relational construct, right? That is both a site of political relations and also networked into a number of different political relations. The borrowing language is just, I agree. It's interesting. Yeah. It does feel a little odd.
Because it presumes an autonomy that I'm not sure I'd be comfortable presuming that autonomy. I think I'd want to say instead the autonomy of the IMF is negotiated, continually negotiated. So maybe it's not entirely the case that the IMF is just like a tool of the United States, but the autonomy that the IMF has is not as a separate entity that we then have a relationship with. Right? That it always occupies a different kind of position in here. But maybe that's just because I'm too hung up on sovereignty. I mean, when I talk about the idea of the borrowing language suggests to me something like, the borrowing language suggests to me something like, we'd like to do a podcast. I don't have a microphone. I'm going to borrow your microphone. Okay, that's borrowing. But that presumes a certain kind, the verbal formulation of that presumes a certain kind of autonomy that we have, and then power becomes a resource, something we're able to sort of transfer between us. There's something off about, in my head, there's something off about like applying that to the IMF, the relationship between the IMF and the United States.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I don't think we can draw a conclusion on that now.
No.
Probably if we were less tired and had less scotch, we would be able to say something a little more intelligent about it, perhaps.
Possibly.
So, and then we've already talked about what happens later on. He then endogenizes agential power into relations and structural power into relations. And then he has that discussion of power of exchange relationships, which is he locates with Baldwin. It's very Berdusian in many respects, right? At least the way I read it. Mm-hmm.
But then there's a weird, almost functionalist moment at the end of the chapter. Relation is power refers to power resources or potential power, etc., etc. You need to manage relations as a power resource so that you can have an ample supply of power resources ready for use. You need to manage power as relations so that you have more positive relationships with others to produce influence and desired results. And you need, this is on page 287, last paragraph of the chapter. So you need to manage power as relations so you have more positive relations with others to produce influence and desired results, and you need to manage the more complex human relations so that the reciprocal cycle of benefit giving and taking is able to empower all parties. including yourself in the process. So when I read that, the two questions I had, which echo things we've talked about before in the text, first of all, what is the status of that need? Is that some sort of a functional imperative of the system? Like, where does that, what does it mean to say that's
I just think it's a need?
And secondly, is that a need that is for any sort of relations, or is that only a need in a relational culture where there's this social norm of bao that's used to govern the exchange act of wrenching?
It is just true by definition that to be able to utilize social capital, you need to maintain and manage relationships.
This goes back to the thing I keep obsessing about here, the lack of an analytical sensibility in this. Because yeah, I mean, a functional argument that is purely used to generate counterfactuals is perfectly fine, but since the status of it is unclear here, it's not clear to me that that's what he's saying. If we take that reading, then sure, then okay, then if we sort of think of that as saying, well, if you don't end up managing these relations, then you won't have these sorts of capacities in the future. Okay, that I can buy. There was something weird about the formulation of it.
Well, I think there's an idea that the relationship is necessarily mutually empowering. And there is this interesting, I mean, this does dovetail with this move. I mean, you saw some of Debbie Avant's work in this idiom and others that to talk about power as positive sum, I think largely drawing from pragmatism. But the idea that, you know, we can collective mobilization is the generation of power, may have distributional consequences, but it's not simply distributional, right? There is power in a union. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this because sort of, I mean, I wonder whether we're reading this unfairly or fairly, whether some of our hesitancy comes again, and we should conclude on this, right? This fight that, this sort of arguments that were going on at this workshop where we were just completely confused for a bunch of time, which was essentially some scholars who are, at least one of whom is Taiwanese, who I think were critiquing him, right? On the grounds that his conception of relationality was a way of masking domination. Is that right? Am I remembering this correctly?
Yes, because that's also a point that he and some of his co-authors have made in other publications that I've read since.
And so I think here maybe part of it is the idea that the proper management of relationships means that, not expressed in the ability of the self to produce influence, it is the ability to enable the co-empowering process. And I think that we would look at this and we would say some relationships are co-empowering, but other relationships are not. And it rests to some degree on whether the statement is conditional, referring to certain kinds of relationships, or whether it's a kind of universal claim about relational management. So, for example, it's obvious that the creation of a client state does empower some people in the client state, but the relationships you're constructing are for the purpose of institutionalizing domination. And maybe that's part of it with the IMF. The U.S. isn't borrowing power from the IMF, the U.S. is exercising dominance. And that maybe is that kind of what's going on here, kind of for us, why we're kind of balking?
I think that may certainly be part of it. That's actually, the more I think about it, the more that's a lot of it.
Because he says that it's institutionalized rules because it used power to establish that. I mean, so it's not like power is absent from this analysis.
No, not at all. But the contrast he drew in chapter 6 between Hegelian and Zhongyang dialectics, there was the centrality of conflict and the centrality of harmony. It now strikes me that the term that's missing in there is domination, which for a more Weberian sociology of the way that power relations work, you would need to talk about domination and the way in which domination was legitimated. That's the whole thing that Weberian sociology is about. But it strikes me that there isn't domination in this particular account. Relationality is because it tends toward harmony, and because the tendency toward harmony for him is an ontological principle that's built into the way relations work, that the proper way to manage relations is to manage them toward harmony. And so even if there's hierarchy, it's not dominance, it's harmonious hierarchy.
Just give some example of harmony, or the idea that if like one partner in the relationship is essentially a loudmouthed asshole, then yep. the harmony is when the other partner in the relationship is sort of, you know, very easygoing and accepting and, you know, complements that.
Yeah. Yeah. And all of the naturalization of the family relations that goes on throughout this. I mean, I could just imagine what some of our feminist colleagues would say about the naturalizing of the gender relations here.
But again, we naturalize lots of stuff in our theory.
Agreed. Absolutely.
That we probably don't even realize because we think they're background knowledge, common sense explanations or illustrations of what we're doing. Right. You know, we have to be, again, I think we need to be a little bit careful in terms of not saying that this is saying these problems are not unique or these issues are not unique. The last thing I just wanted to close out with is that I do think that one of the things I find really interesting here about the relationality of the theory is this emphasis on what we have termed modalities of relations. You might think about them as primarily relational identities, but they're not identities in the Taleian sense of a boundary, right? They're identities in the sense of like a role conception.
Right.
And that, but the role is of course embedded in that relationship as a matter of ontological and analytical principle, or it's a co-role, right? A coexistence. And I do think this emphasis on kind of how different forms, different kinds of content of relationships goes into a relational approach is really interesting and is probably a good corrective to some of the over-reliance on formal network analysis in IR, in the areas we come out of. Is that fair? Do you agree with that at all?
I do. I think that to the extent that it's possible to be a humanist without being an individualist, that would be an interesting corrective. And I think that may be what he's trying to get at. I think sometimes the very language, and this may also just be a function of the way the English language works, that you end up with a positing of these individual subjects that have to do things, that may be sort of creeping back into the way that he's describing this. Because he's not an individualist. He doesn't want to be an individualist. He ends up utilizing some of those terms. Now, that may be because he's engaging with these sets of individualist theories, these individualist ontologies that are driving the kinds of theories that we have. But I agree with you. What he's trying to do is redress some of that, I don't know, inhuman character of the kinds
mechanistic.
Of mechanistic, sort of purely formal ways of talking that comes specifically out of the social network stuff. It's interesting because, you know, I've started finally working on this Weber book that I've been threatening to write for years. And one of the interesting things is this debate that if you sort of contrast Weber's thinking about the form-content distinction with Simmel's thinking about form-content, that Weber actually is much more, in the terms we've just been using, kind of humanistic about this, that Weber actually thinks content matters a lot more and is not interested in the sort of spare geometry of social forms the way Simmel was. So there may be some interesting, let me back off and rephrase that a little bit. Reading this book may help me appreciate aspects of Weber that I had not quite seen in the same way because I hadn't been characterizing it in those terms. But I think there's something very interesting about his attempt, Chin's attempt, to flesh out a relationalism that doesn't completely abandon the more humanistic language.
And ironically, that probably puts him closer in sensibility to pragmatism, even though the architecture of the theory looks more network relational or relationally realist in many respects.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I think so. And I think that he does that, especially if we had lots more time to talk about the 10th chapter and rules, we could bring Onuf in, but maybe one day we'll do Onuf on the podcast and we could talk about rules.
So the bad news is our time indicator says 3 hours and 15 minutes. The good news is that some of that time is actually us warming up at the beginning.
And then there's that part, and then there's that part in the middle.
Yeah, so I'm going to see if I can creatively edit this. But it's been fun. That was really challenging. This is a hard book, and I mean in a good way. It's meaty, and there aren't a lot of books that are this meaty being produced right now.
It is definitely a book that the next time I get an opportunity to teach a graduate IR theory seminar, I will almost certainly assign.
This is totally going into the my IR theories and approaches course when I cycle back into teaching, which will probably be next year. This is going on it, but I will assign some of the debates around it as well, around his theories as well, I think. Does that sound like what you would do?
That sounds exactly like what I would do. In fact, what I would also try to do is I'd see if there was some way to Skype him in to answer some
questions.
That
would be awesome. I don't know if you'd have time or something like that. I will say that my only reservation about assigning it is that I feel really odd and creepy about assigning anything where I am in it, let alone having written it.
Well, you know, my solution to this, when I teach that class, I co-teach it, and usually it's my co-teacher who insists on putting stuff in that has me in it. So when I'm co-teaching with Ann Tickner and Ann says, but we have to read your book, Patrick, I said, well, okay, yes, Ann, you said so. So that's fine. I'll put it in there. I was kind of humbled to see the praise, critical praise, but praise that he heaped on that particular article of ours.
We haven't even talked about what we're going to do next time. But let's, before we do that, let's make sure that we have a sign off. So anyway, as I said, it's been fun. I guess I'll see you in maybe a month, maybe sooner.
That sounds good. I liked the little interstitial article version of the podcast that we did, even though that turned into a full-length podcast. But since the quarantine isn't going away anytime soon, I think we're going to have plenty of time to keep doing this.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that largely we just, you know, if you let us go like this, we'll just talk for 3 hours and we'll just keep going. And wow, it's just terrible. But, oh my God, the problem with reading a book like this is it is really long, right? It's 280 pages, 290 pages with all the stuff that's going on around us. And so we can talk for the same amount of time in an article, but we can read it more closely and I think more fairly. So we'll have to think about that. Anyway, so long. Bye.
See ya.